Hello and welcome to the Majlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, the Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Radio Free Europe, the Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. So you might recall that the topic of our last episode was also about this issue, but since then we have seen some visible, touchable signs indicative of the thinking in Central Asia in terms of the ongoing Russian war in Ukraine. Over the last few days, we have seen Russian officials courting Central Asian leaders. There were meetings, phone traffic between Central Asia and Russia and Central Asia and Ukraine and between leaders within Central Asia. While authorities have been busy in high politics, we have seen public-centric activities in the region, mostly in support of Ukraine, and it is growing. And also real signs of economic implications as they remain overwhelmingly dependent on Russia. So in this episode, we will dive into some of those indicators and try to make sense of where Central Asia finds itself in the crisis, what they say, what they don't say, and what do they tell us about what comes next. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Ambassador William Courtney, former U.S. Ambassador to Kazakhstan, currently Adjunct Senior Fellow at the RAND Corporation, Dr. Nargis Kasanova, a Senior Fellow at the Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Dr. Kasanova is from Kazakhstan, Timur Omarov, a Research Fellow at the Carnegie Russia in Moscow, who is from Uzbekistan, and Bruce Panier, Senior Central Asia Analyst and the editor and curator of an upcoming RFERL Central Asia newsletter starting from April 5th. So welcome on board, colleagues. I'm so excited that you could join us in this very important conversation. A lot has been happening in Central Asia in the context of Russia's war in Ukraine. Obviously, as we discussed in the previous episodes, the implications of this crisis will be hugely consequential in the region. In the last conversation, we were looking into this in the context of possibilities, but some signs are already popping up, both on political and economic levels. So I'm sure we will not be able to touch all of them. Let's try to look into some of the highlights from your perspective. Let's start with you, Dr. Kasanova. So what has been the highlight of those events in terms of ways in which this crisis is touching your country, Kazakhstan?
Well, there are so many signs. Definitely now we see that, you know, there was a situation before and the situation after, and we are in this kind of in the uncharted waters, because kind of the security and political order we had in the post-Soviet space is now indefinitely upended. There is a major upheaval. God knows order will be emerging. There is already an impact on the financial and economic situation. Well, I'm speaking about my country. Kazakhstan is bracing for the impact. There was a meeting of Tokayev and the Economic Council and the businessmen to decide how to proceed, what measures are necessary, because definitely the crisis is upon us. There's the news about published by your outlet, Mohammed, about Kazakhstan now diverting its cargo from Russian ports to Latvian ones. So it's just such a multifaceted crisis. We are bracing for it, but it's still not clear what kind of the scale of it will be.
Nargis, just one kind of follow-up on that. So Kazakhstan diverting cargo from Russian to Latvian ports. Is it is it economic decision or political decision? What is it?
Well, it is an economic decision, but forced definitely by the political decisions, and first of all, the decision made by Russia. So now Russia is under huge sanctions, and we need to find a way kind of to operate under the circumstances, because definitely Kazakhstan is not ready to side with Russia the way Belarus did. As you know, in the UN General Assembly, Kazakhstan abstained. In the UN Human Rights Council, Kazakhstan abstained. Oh, and at the also Ministry of Defense said that Kazakhstan is neutral in this crisis. We're not supporting Russia. We're not supporting Ukraine. And not supporting Russia, who is considered to be the strategic ally number one of Kazakhstan, and, you know, we're members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. That's a pretty big position.
Ambassador Courtney, you are more familiar with the high-level thinking among the authorities in Kazakhstan than us. You know, there was also kind of very interesting, intriguing step by the Kazakh President Tokayev when he decided to take call from Ukrainian President Zelensky in the middle of all this. What does that kind of tell you?
Kazakhstan has had a multi-vector foreign policy from the beginning. It is seen having a balance of forces, if you will, to offset each other as enhancing Kazakhstan's independence, sovereignty. Having ties with Ukraine, talking with President Zelensky, will definitely help Kazakhstan with the West, for example, and also with people who are in Kazakhstan who are concerned about what might happen if Russia wins in Ukraine. Could the ultranationalists in Russia decide that Russia should seize the northern oblasts in Kazakhstan or Kazakhstan's Caspian oil? So I think Kazakhstan does have to proceed carefully, does have to keep ties open with a number of people, but it will not want to anger the Kremlin.
But the call, Ambassador, I mean, that wouldn't make Kremlin happy either. In the middle of a war, when Russia is isolated and trying to rally as much support as possible in its camp, suddenly you see a country in your backyard speaking to your enemy. I mean, obviously, it was a bold step by President Tokayev, a step, I think, which Kremlin wouldn't be happy about, isn't it?
Yes, it was an important step. But I think it is in the context of the multi-vector strategy that Kazakhstan has pursued all along. And we really have to face the fact now that if Russia wins in Ukraine, and that's not yet clear what the outcome will be, one could expect the ultranationalists in Russia to be emboldened and start looking for other targets. If, on the other hand, the war in Ukraine causes government to collapse in the Kremlin from internal stresses and strains, then it will be important for Kazakhstan to have maintained good relations with the West and with others. Kazakhstan will, of course, be aware that China is not fully behind Russia's aggression in Ukraine as well. So I think this is a smart step on the part of Tokayev. Mm-hmm.
How it was seen, Timur, you are sitting in Moscow, how that call was seen in Russia? Have you heard anything authorities talk about this? Anything media has written about this these days? Whatever media says in Russia, I mean, obviously because of the reasons that we know, sort of reflects the sentiments of the authorities in Russia these days. And so what was the reaction to that particular call in Moscow?
I have to say that right now the media in Russia is kind of devastated. If we take a look at what is happening with independent media, it's in the worst situation ever. And that is why there is no much information except for the official information. But I don't see much being said about Kazakhstan's President Tokayev calling to Zelensky. And actually, if we take a look at what happened before that, we will see that Tokayev, before calling Zelensky, called Vladimir Putin. In these times, the only thing that we can do is to speculate. In different Telegram channels that are kind of associated with the Kremlin, with Kazakhstan elites, there are rumors that Tokayev wants to become this middle person between two conflicting sides, because Kazakhstan, as well as many other countries in Central Asia and in other parts of the world, will suffer a lot after what happens with Ukraine. And that is why Tokayev wants everything to stop as quick as possible. And there are these rumors that during the call with Putin, he asked to stop it as soon as possible. During the call with Zelensky, he asked to start negotiations. So he really wants to do something to prevent catastrophe for Kazakh economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like there are so many other countries who are trying to do the same thing when it comes to this tension there. But I guess, Nargis, you might also want to jump in here. When there was an article in a Russian website, Regnom, right? The Russian site. Yeah. It was very, yes, very provocative, almost accusing the Kazakh leadership of setting the course for Ukrainization. I don't know whether it had to, yes, do anything with the position that Kazakh authorities are trying to take here by staying neutral. What was your read into that?
Yes, well, that was a very strange article, and it is written by Aynur Kurmanov, who was member of the Communist Party. Then he set up his own socialist resistance movement, and then he was also kind of in alliance with Ablyazov. Then he moved to Moscow, and since then he had been publishing strange articles that were very much in line with some of the Kremlin propaganda tropes. And this article is sort of, I see it as the culmination of these activities, because it's written with the knowledge of the details of what's happening, but all these things are framed in the kind of this propaganda trope ways. What he calls Ukrainization, these are fairly normal processes of nation building in Kazakhstan. There is nothing wrong in the decision to use more the state language, Kazakh language, in the public spaces. There is nothing wrong in the decision to Latinize the alphabet. It's it's really an internal matter. There is no discrimination of Russians or other ethnic groups in the republic. The authorities have been quite careful in this regard, and that's the policy that has been consistent. So it's a very kind of very biased perspective on what has been happening in Kazakhstan.
No, there are so many biased comments these days we see here and there. I mean, and when you look into this from the timing perspective, kind of, makes you raise this question. I mean, why this article, this in this language, popping up at this particular time? And earlier, there was also another news reports, and it was published in a number of outlets, by the way, about a Kazakhstan denying a Russian request to contribute militarily in whatever happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, that was also a very strange report. And I think it was NBC that first first put it out, and it's not clear to me where exactly they were taking this information. I don't think there was a request by the Russians to Kazakhstan to send troops to help them, and our authorities deny that. And it's just I can't see how anything like that could have happened. So there is a lot of information, and some of it is fake, some of it is just God knows, probably that people are putting together stories in a hurry, and people who don't know the situation are putting together stories that are, kind of these 5-minute experts now in the field. So it's just so much is happening and everybody's in a hurry.
Yeah, you're right. And also, I guess it was today, the response came from Kazakh authorities. Yeah, particularly the Kazakh defense minister saying that his country is and will remain neutral, and sending the military to Ukraine is out of question. So
absolutely.
Does this put a full stop to this conversation, that Kazakhstan won't be there militarily in any way, form, or shape?
I'm pretty sure Kazakhstan will not be there, and I can't see how any other Central Asians would be there. I don't know if you saw the Kyrgyz story, this a story from Kyrgyzstan, some outlet reposting a story about Kyrgyzstan also kind of preparing to give assistance to Russia. And actually, now the journalist is detained. So definitely none of us is ready to contribute.
Yeah. Speaking of the Kyrgyzstan, there was a phone call between Kyrgyz President Sadir Japarov and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Obviously, I'm not aware in terms of the exact context in which this conversation took place, but there was a reaction by Ukrainian side by recalling its ambassador to Kyrgyzstan.
Yes.
Maybe, Bruce, you would like to jump in here. I mean, what happened in that conversation, and how do you see the reaction by the Ukrainians?
Kyrgyzstan's position on this has been by far the most, at least the government officials, and I mean the president and head of the cabinet, really lean toward Russia on this one. They're the only country that's shown that so far. Like Japarov, right after Putin announced recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk and started talking about historical Russian lands and stuff, Japarov posted on Facebook that Kyrgyzstan's position was always based on the need to comply with the Minsk agreements, and that unfortunately the failure to fulfill these agreements had led to the current difficulties, which seemed to go along with what Putin was saying. That, it was Ukraine that was at fault for starting this by not honoring the Minsk agreements. And so that was, the Kyrgyz position. And then, of course, the head of the cabinet, Akhobek Japarov, met with Mishustin and said that, and relayed a message that he had gotten from Japarov that Kyrgyzstan had been, or the Kyrgyz had been with Russia for 200 years and would be for 300 more years. I mean, that's so much further than anyone else in Central Asia is gone with this one. That you can see why the Ukrainians, this is part of a pattern. I mean, this is not like an off-the-cuff remark. I mean, this has been repeated. So you can see why the Ukrainians are unhappy with Kyrgyzstan. The other Central Asian states have tried to their best to keep out of this. I mean, their statements are so bland on what's happening, and they almost always include something about the need for a peaceful resolution to this conflict. If they even mention it at all, in the case of Turkmenistan, they don't even bring it up. But that's kind of hard, like I said, for a lot of people in Kyrgyzstan. I think that that's the attitude of the president, that whether they support Russia or not, saying we'll be with you no matter what.
Can I jump in for a, for a second?
Yeah.
But at the same time, Kyrgyzstan abstained in the UN General Assembly vote. Unlike Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, they didn't show up, right? They didn't vote, which puzzles me. Well, Turkmenistan doesn't puzzle me, but the decision of Uzbekistan not to vote sort of puzzled me personally. I would be curious what Timur thinks about.
You know, and I also want to throw in, too, that, you know, I understand that Kyrgyzstan's in a rough position with this. They're real dependent on the Russian economy. You know, hundreds of thousands of migrant laborers. There's a lot of ties that bind them together. I was just kind of surprised that Kyrgyzstan didn't line up its position with the other Central Asian states, which is pretty much, you know, noncommittal and as neutral as possible.
Maybe, Ambassador, you might have a kind of a bigger picture view on that. I mean, this UN vote, the way Central Asia voted at UN, I'm sure, you know, and I don't like to put you in Putin's shoes here, but it wouldn't make Putin happy, isn't it, the way they voted?
The United Nations vote was important in the international community context to signal where countries were going. And as I mentioned, the Chinese abstention rather than supporting Russia was pretty significant. With regard to the Central Asian votes, I don't think in the West people would pay a lot of attention to those votes because they realize each of the Central Asian countries is under various kinds of pressure. So to make a comparison, if Kazakhstan or any other Central Asian country were to provide troops for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that would have a very deleterious effect on their relations with the West. For Kazakhstan, that would be a violation of its multi-vector foreign policy. But a United Nations vote is less important, and often, you know, people do realize that countries have to vote certain ways sometimes for particular interests.
Yeah.
And Kyrgyzstan's vote is not all that important in the Western scheme of things.
No, I was trying to look into this from Russian perspective, like, you know, a situation in which Russia gets only, what's that, 4 or 5 votes in favor? But the rest either abstained, of course, overwhelming majority voted against Russia. I mean, Russia would want to have any vote possible in its basket. So you see in the backyard, those Central Asian countries, they abstained. I mean, abstaining, I guess, the way I understand it, does not mean supporting Russian position, which I guess Putin wouldn't like to see that way.
I agree with you, Mohammed. I think that's quite a stance that's taking some guts. Because, yes, if you are ally of Russia, a client state of Russia, so dependent on Russia, abstaining in this vote, it is a position. And if we go back to the Crimea vote 2014, we also didn't see the support of that as well. At the time, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan abstained, the others didn't vote.
If I would also cite the case of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The support that Russia received in that case was really quite small. So in some sense, Russia is probably accustomed to being isolated without too many other votes on some of its controversial stances.
Do you see like a situation in which Russia is going to press Central Asian authorities going forward to take the Russian side? Obviously, now we don't know where Russia is going to end up in Ukraine crisis. I don't know in which ways going forward that crisis is going to be put on vote on international platforms. And then you have the cases of so-called Luhansk and Donetsk republics and their future. I mean, do you see ways in which Russia is going to try to press Central Asians to take its side, Ambassador?
Yes, I think that's very much the case. So looking back over the last 30 years, Russia has never been more internally repressive than it is now, and it has never been more externally aggressive than it is now. If Russia wins the war in Ukraine, and if the current regime stays in power, one can expect that ultra-nationalists, chauvinists, irredentists are going to be emboldened. And so pressure by Russia on Central Asian countries is likely to grow.
Let me add on that. I really don't think that right now for Moscow, number one goal here is to legally get support from other countries. What Russia, it's really difficult to rationalize everything that is happening right now. But in my view, de facto having those territories as a buffer zones, it's number one goal here for Russia. And Russia, I don't think, will be thinking about getting support from Central Asia at this moment. But what everyone has already said, I think, one more time shows how Russia is lonely. And right now, and Russia's actions in Ukraine right now are making Russia more lonely. And maybe it has never been so lonely ever. And from Central Asian point of view, it's really, you know, not logical right now to make any decisions because, I mean, it's politics and everyone is pragmatic here and no one wants to support the loser here. And at this moment, Russia seems to be alone and the West is united as ever before.
And then there was a phone call, Bruce, we were talking about this earlier, phone call between President Tokayev and President Mirziyayev in the middle of all this. And obviously, it's, you know, the way it was reflected on their websites, they spoke about like bilateral trades. I do not expect the whole conversation to be about bilateral relations at this moment. So what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I mean, I saw that too, and it's really hard. What they release, you always understand that they talked about a lot more than what's in the press releases. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, I think the closest they came to mentioning what was happening in Ukraine was that they discussed, you know, contemporary political or international issues. Mm-hmm. Or something, right? International news never said anything about what was happening in Ukraine at all, you know. And we were talking about that. And like I said, I thought it was interesting when I was reading that to think that the two presidents are probably looking at two different problems. Clearly, for Tokayev, Ukraine would be the number one issue, you know, with no doubt about it. Although he's in his, you know, we haven't mentioned yet, but he's in kind of an interesting position because he just needed Russian help in the form of the CSTO at the start of the year. You know, I'm sure Putin's written down somewhere in there that, you know, in some notebook that Tokayev was less than supportive of what Russia's doing, even though Putin had helped him out earlier. But if you're Mirziyoyev and you're bordering Afghanistan, and the focus of world attention has gone away from Afghanistan, you know, the Ukraine war is a disaster for that reason also. You know, Tajikistan is probably even worse, you know, because they claim there's tens of thousands of militants on the other side of their border that are ready to come across. And to watch Russia is totally distracted with what's happening in Ukraine. 150,000 troops committed to this and not making great progress either. And if you're in Tajikistan and your threat is south of the border, you got to wonder what's going on. And Mirziyoyev's kind of in the same position. So when they talked about, you know, when the readout said they talked about major international events, I understood that they had to have said something about Ukraine, but I kind of felt for a little bit for Mirziyoyev that he probably, that's not his biggest security problem.
Now, very, very, very interesting point. And speaking of Uzbekistan in the context of Afghanistan, I guess this week some high-level Uzbek delegation is also in Washington, D.C. And I mean, Uzbekistan was trying to use Afghanistan Kurd as something to improve its image in Washington, D.C., that they are a party and they could make a difference in this thing, things like that. And suddenly you have the Ukrainian crisis pushing back everything about Afghanistan to the backseat. So they are here in Washington, D.C. this week and kind of organizing meetings here and there and to talk about what role they can play in Afghanistan. So that's one thing. And also just a last question before we move on to some of the public level sentiment about this crisis in Central Asia. Ambassador Courtney, last week, Secretary Blinken also had a phone conversation with all the Central Asian foreign ministers. Was it kind of a routine call? I mean, again, nothing seems to be routine to me these days because, you know, given the situation in Ukraine.
So you are right, Mohammed. This is not normal. The Blinken administration has made enormous efforts to reach out to allies and friends on the Ukraine issue and Russia's aggression. In this contrast, you may recall, to Biden administration's not being so active in consulting and not taking into account the views so much of its allies and friends in the Afghanistan withdrawal. So the Blinken administration seems to have learned a lesson and is now reaching out everywhere it can, often. Central Asian countries are important, and the idea that Secretary Blinken would talk with them to reassure them about the approach the West was taking. Certainly in Washington, there's awareness that the Central Asian countries will suffer economic collateral damage from the sanctions on Russia, the new sanctions. But of course, the Central Asians have been dealing with this issue for 8 years because of the sanctions imposed on Russia in response to its 2014 invasion of Ukraine. But collateral damage this time is going to be a lot higher. For example, Sberbank, which is active throughout the region, Sberbank is now sanctioned. And so this is going to pose some financial constraints. And I think Secretary Blinken wanted to reassure the countries that the West was still supportive and express some sympathy for the fact that, you know, there will be some economic collateral damage.
Yeah, so the economic side of the story, right? And then there's a growing public level sentiment, and I'm sure it differs country to country and city to city. But I've seen Kazakhs are actively running campaigns to collect donation for Ukraine. I saw a video of members of Uzbek intelligentsia visiting the Ukrainian embassy, I guess yesterday or today in Tashkent, to express solidarity with people in Ukraine. And there is mixed reaction by the authorities in response to these activities. Obviously, we are already seeing the economic implications of what Russia is going through, given the overwhelming dependency of Central Asians to the Russian market. So let's continue the conversation talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate. Today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Ambassador William Courtney, former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan, currently adjunct senior fellow at the Rand Corporation, Dr. Nergis Kasanova, senior fellow at the Harvard Davis Center for Russia and Eurasian Studies, Timur Umarov, a research fellow at the Carnegie Russia in Moscow, and Bruce Spanier, senior Central Asia analyst. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Press Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the Central Asia's reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So public reaction, Nargis, Kazakhstanis have been active. Again, I was just reading a story from our own Kazakh service there. I mean, there is a number of NGOs came together and they set up a center in Almaty and donations are pouring in and they are transferring them to the Ukrainian embassy or through Poland to Ukraine. I mean, the public sentiment seems to be very different than what the authorities' position is on this crisis.
Right, Mohammed. But before I go to the public sentiment, maybe just one sentence on the economic situation. That now we are dealing not just with the official sanctions. Now these are also companies, right? Many Western companies, or global companies, IKEA and so on, Apple, you know, stopping business with Russia. It's a very different situation from what we had before. So the impact is amplified. On the public sentiment, indeed. Well, the public is not constrained the way the government is. They can be driven by...
Before you go to the public sentiment, since you raised this economic aspect, I had just a couple of notes to share with our audience. I guess we are talking about here the story of last week, Kazakhstan's response to Russian currency losing value. Kazakhstan's central bank injected $138 million from its currency reserves into the domestic market on February 24th. And then following that, on February 28th, they also injected additional $98 million from its reserves to the market. I mean, it's we are talking about like hundreds of millions of dollars coming out of their reserves to be able to respond to this crisis, a developing crisis.
This is expensive, probably unwise to try to prop up the currency because the ruble is likely to go down further. And the other currencies in Central Asia are also going to have to accommodate. You know, there's speculation in the financial markets today that the ruble could go down to 200 to the dollar. So to try to prop up any of the other non-Russian currencies at this point may be not only premature, but could be expensive, could be good money going down the drain.
On ruble, though, Timur, it must be felt in Uzbekistan. I mean, they depend on Russian market on so many levels. How authorities there are responding to these financial kind of difficulties emerging from this crisis?
Yeah, Uzbekistan's economy will definitely suffer a lot because, first of all, Uzbekistan, you know, has a great amount of trade with Russia and the investments from Russia also have a big chunk in Uzbek economy. But for now, what I see is that authorities are not quick enough to react to those, you know, coming changes. And what I see is authorities are being even too calm and not ready. But on the other hand, what, you know, other ways Uzbekistan has out of this situation? I do believe that Uzbekistan has little economic instruments to make something and not let catastrophe to happen. But the consequences are going to come to Uzbekistan, not now, but very soon.
Have you seen they are taking any step to prevent that type of scenario from becoming real?
Yeah, for example, there was a order from Uzbekistan Central Bank to all commercial banks to change the rate of ruble during the day several times and to make it according to the market price. But not all of the commercial banks have been following these recommendations from Central Bank. And some economists say that some, you know, Russian oligarchs that have access to Uzbek banking system can use this as a way out and to change their rubles to Uzbek sums and then to exchange to dollars. So I think that Uzbekistan is not doing enough to cope with the situation. But on the other hand, Uzbekistan is kind of in a very bad situation because no matter what actions authorities are going to take, the crisis is going to hit Uzbek economy very soon. Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing is obviously remittances. Like what's that? The number 7.8 million migrants from countries of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan were registered in Russia in 2021 as migrant workers, and more than 4.5 million of them were coming from Uzbekistan and 2.4 from Tajikistan. And the money that they sent make up huge chunk of their GDPs back their home, and obviously they are paid in rubles. And the money that they send every month to their home countries, that's not going to be the same as they used to in the past. And I'm not sure how the employment situation is going to look like. Again, there is a period, I guess, in which migrant workers go to Russia to work for. I guess this is not yet has come for this year. And the earlier our Tajik service was reporting that number of flights already canceled, which was scheduled to fly to Russia in coming weeks. So from the employment perspective, we are also going to see that kind of implication coming on our way soon. And again, it's yet to be seen how it is going to impact domestically those countries and how the authorities there are going to deal with that situation, whether they have means to deal with it. Yeah, there are lots of questions, and we yet to see the real impact that coming soon. But earlier, Nargis, you were talking about the...
Well, with regard to Uzbekistan, I wonder what's going to happen to the Russian investments in Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. We all know that the Russian-Uzbek oligarchs played a big role. So now that Usmanov's assets are, you know, arrested and all that, that's another blow, I would imagine, to the Uzbek economy. Mm. Also on the migrants, Central Asian migrants in Russia, now we hear sinister stories about the kind of about migrants enlisting as contractors in the Russian army because they're promised a quick citizenship. You know, kind of the citizenship applications be considered within 3 months.
Almost forgot that. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
There are kind of in these leaked lists, there are Tajik names and already corpses, right? Central Asians dying there. So that's I think a big and very kind of it is definitely an issue because, you know, people are getting desperate and, you know, they made these promises and they go and fight and they, you know, they are definitely not trained and, you know, overall it's just all, you know, kind of really horrible. As for the public sentiments, indeed, we see a lot of public support. That there is a sense that it is a very unjust war and that Russia is an aggressor. And also there is a sense of affinity. There is a sense that, you know, Ukraine is fighting for all of us against the imperialist Russia. And there are apolitical people also who are horrified by what they see, and seeing these explosions and, you know, people wounded, dying and so on. And they are kind of ready to collect humanitarian aid, and there are already planes full of Kazakhstani humanitarian aid going to Ukraine. Money is collected, and fairly good sums of money. And the authorities, yes, they are much more careful. And as already said, unlike the public, they are constrained. Traditionally, for 30 years, Russia was our, you know, strategic ally number one. We are in the, you know, together in the Eurasian Economic Union. And let's see what's going to happen to that, right? All these, I think, overall regional arrangements now in disarray. So I do understand why the authorities are treading very, very softly. But the public can kind of express themselves. There was a small protest that was combined with the environmental protest, and they were not detained.
That's also interesting, yeah? In Kazakhstan, usually you are not, you know, allowed to protest.
Yeah, I don't think they will allow anything on a big scale, but people are so busy with, you know, collecting assistance and, you know, kind of doing useful things. But for me, it was very interesting that Kazakhstani police has been stopping cars with the put Z sign, and putting huge fines. So people were kind of really stopped and fined. So Kazakhstan doesn't want any of this on its territory, which I think is quite important.
That's very, very interesting. Like, you know, the earlier I was referring to our Kazakh service reporting, I mean, the way NGOs came together and the way they are collecting money. And there was an interview with one of the leaders of that NGO, and she was saying, like, you know, money is pouring in from left and right, from cities to the regions and villages. And at some point, bank blocks the account, asking why all this money is coming to your account. So the NGO had to provide them justification so that they lift the block. And then they are buying various items that could be transported to Ukraine. And one story was very interesting. You know, it looks like it's an all-out campaign of some sort, like a bar owner's story there. The bar owner was thinking, okay, how I can help? You know, they said, okay, why not to organize like a weekly concert or something? Whatever donation comes in, and let's, you know, send it to Ukrainian embassy's way. I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, where this sentiment is coming from, Nergis?
Oh, people are against the war, you know, and it's just seen as very unjust. And, well, of course, partially we are in Russia's information space. People are exposed to the kind of toxic Russian propaganda on Ukraine, you know, the abuses in Donbass and, you know, all that. But we are not in the kind of in the same grip of this as Russia is, obviously. I think people kind of do understand that we are in the same boat with Ukraine to some extent. Of course, Putin, Kremlin, they don't feel in the same emotional way about northern Kazakhstan or Central Asia as they feel about the Slavic brotherly republics. Now, I don't know if we can even call them brotherly anymore, but there is that sense that Russia can do this to you, you know, because it is stronger. It seems it's not bound by any agreements, and it's not bound by the norms that we thought that were in place.
Yeah, it also kind of makes me think that one of the unintended consequences of this crisis in Ukraine, at least speaking of Central Asia, that people, at least some people, are finally realizing the negative effect of what our Uzbek service director, who was in our conversation in the last week's episode, he referred to, you know, zombie box, the Russian television channels. I mean, finally, people are kind of realizing the negative kind of effect of that information channel, because we always say that region is under the Russian sphere of influence in terms of the information. At least, you know, some people are realizing that what they say might not be the true and coming out to the street in solidarity with Ukraine. That's very, very interesting. And on the Uzbekistan, Timur, the group of intelligentsia, obviously, number of those people that they would, as far as I can tell from the clip that I was watching today, they are just few people. But the fact that they went to the Ukrainian embassy and talk about President Putin when he's done with Ukraine, whether Central Asia could be under threat, things like that. They are talking about those kind of issues in their meeting with the ambassador. I thought that's kind of a courageous, bold move. But in the meantime, just outside of the embassy, there were kind of people taking their pictures coming in to the embassy and going out of the embassy. Well, how you would kind of, sum up the way the Uzbek people have been reacting to the situation in Ukraine and how the authorities were dealing with it?
Yeah, actually, if we compare Uzbekistan to what Nargis has been saying to Kazakhstan, first of all, we should understand that the society in Uzbekistan is quite different, and the atmosphere that people live here in Uzbekistan is quite different from what people in Kazakhstan have. The level of the civil society, for example, in Kazakhstan is much more strong and has an experience of supporting each other and creating some kind of networks and protesting, actually. But this was not the case for Uzbekistan, and that is why we don't see that much of support coming from Uzbekistan, if we even compare to Kazakhstan. But what we really see is that some people really opened their eyes and right now look at Russia's actions in post-Soviet space from the completely different perspective. I mean, even maybe 2 weeks ago, nobody expected something like this to happen in the 21st century. But right now, it seems that Vladimir Putin doesn't follow any rules and everything can happen. So that is why some people change their mind about balance of power, their relations with Ukraine, Russia's actions in other parts of the world, because now they realize that if Russia does something on the other part of the world, why it cannot happen here in Central Asia. And that is why they're changing their mind. But saying all that, we still have, especially in the big cities, a lot of people who still do watch Russian TV because it's, the quality of it, it's much better than the quality of Uzbek TV. Mm-hmm. And it's just entertaining. And that is why they do routinely switch on TV and watch all of this Russian propaganda. Mm-hmm. And that is why they fall into this narrative.
Yeah, obviously, people are free to say whatever they say, at least on some level, on social media. I guess discussion on social media reflects a different tune versus what the official line is about the situation in Ukraine. And Bruce, earlier, actually, there are 2 points that I would like to talk about Kyrgyzstan there. One was, speaking of the Russian TV, I guess I have seen this note coming out of our Kyrgyz service the other day. Apparently, there are Russian channels on cable television there, and authorities are paying for those channels in Russia to make their channels available in Kyrgyzstan. There was a member of the parliament raising this question during one of his speeches in the parliament, saying that we need to stop that. Well, that's one thing. The other thing is there has also been protests in Kyrgyzstan. Is there anything to note? I mean, obviously, Kyrgyz are very open-minded people, and the protesting is easier there, I guess, than any other Central Asian country. So how they have been reacting, is there anything in terms of your takeaways?
In terms of rebroadcasting, of course, I don't know how much money exactly it would save, but Russian TV has really been kind of a double-edged sword. Mm. I'm remembering that, that Russian soft power through the news was responsible for helping oust, former President Bakiyev in 2010. So, that just shows kind of the, I suppose, to everybody in Kyrgyzstan, the power that Russian television can have. And, and at this moment, we know what Russian television is dishing out to its audience. So, and I can sympathize because I used to have to watch Soviet television at the Harriman Institute in the late 1980s. So I know what this programming looks like, except now it's clearly pro-Russian military. But yeah, heavy doses of that could help shift opinion. And, that feeds into the next question you had, which was the popular opinion. And it's hard to judge exactly how many people are against the war, but there has been more protests, albeit small, but one did have 100 people, outside the Russian embassy against the war in Ukraine. So you would have to, such information as exists would suggest that there's a lot of people in Kyrgyzstan who are against what Russia is doing in Ukraine right now. And of course, and more broadly, the worry that, as Ambassador Courtney mentioned with northern Kazakhstan, that, they might be next on the hit list, if Russia gets control of Ukraine and they keep talking about historic Russian lands and things like that, they might turn their eye towards Central Asia. But like I said, there's people in the cities with access to more information and good internet connections probably have a much broader base to draw on to form their opinions, whereas people in the countryside probably just relying on a couple of news sources. And so it's difficult to say. But generally, I think curious that people's nature would be anti-war. And past that, you know, this is between two countries that they both know very well. So I can't see that they would support something like this generally in Kyrgyzstan, you know, despite what the government has said, pretty much knuckling under without saying they're on Russia's side, clearly indicating they think that Ukraine's at fault for starting this.
Interesting. And just to add one more thought there, I was earlier referring to the reporting by our Kazakh service. I mean, the people who are donating to this fund, I guess there was an option to write message what this donation for, and majority of the donation was coming under the title of "We don't want to be next." Interesting sentiment there. So I guess we also need to wrap up the conversation. Maybe let's do it with you, Ambassador Courtney. So what I wanted to kind of ask you is, so what's your takeaway, Ambassador, from what we have seen so far in terms of Central Asians' reaction to this, and also where your eyes will be in terms of on what comes next for the region and in terms of the implications of the crisis in Ukraine to the region, where you will be looking at and what will be indications for you to determine in terms of where we go from here?
The signs of unrest, unease in Moscow that we're seeing, the number of people, number of intelligentsia, even some business leaders are beginning to speak out now. Central Asian countries need to maintain a careful balance because it is possible that the current leadership in the Kremlin will not survive this debacle in Ukraine. On the other hand, it could survive, and if it does survive, then it's likely to be more aggressive toward Central Asia, more controlling toward Central Asia. So Central Asian countries really need to maintain a balance. Either outcome is possible. You know, the possibility of regime change in Russia probably has not been so great in 30 years as it is now. So Central Asian countries, what I see, they are being careful about this. If the current leadership does survive the war in Ukraine and stays in power, I think we can expect that the Eurasian Economic Union, for example, Russia will dictate terms more than negotiate terms as they have done in the past. There'll be other measures. If Russia controls all of the ports to the outside world or access to the outside world, now after taking control of the Azov Sea and Black Sea ports in Ukraine, if it does that, if it seizes Odessa, this could have adverse economic impacts on export industries and imports in terms of making imports more expensive and exports with less of the money coming back to Central Asian producers. So there will be those kinds of economic implications. All in all, I think the Central Asian countries have a lot at stake in the outcome of the war in Ukraine, and they are right to be giving support to it because the concern that Central Asia could be next, that's a valid concern.
Mm-hmm. Also, your thoughts kind of gave me another question to raise, Ambassador, before we end the conversation. I mean, as a result of these sanctions that we have seen so far, and I guess more is coming against Russia, Central Asians, regardless of what Russia thinks about it, Central Asia needs to diversify. It is trade, it is financial, you know, relationship with outside the country, perhaps in some ways political relationship with outside of the region for their own survival. So what I'm saying is, Ambassador, is there anything this crisis offer as an opportunity for Central Asia?
As an opportunity?
Yeah. Is there anything that can be seen as an opportunity for Central Asia? I mean, that they have to work on, you know, diversifying their relationship with outside beyond Russia as a result of these sanctions.
I think for Central Asia, this crisis is mostly downsides unless Russia fails in Ukraine. Ukraine maintains its independence and the government changes in a more liberal and open government in Moscow comes to pass. That is one circumstance in which the Central Asians would be better off. But in if the current government stays in power, I think, you know, this is going to be a tougher time for Central Asia. The geographic access to global markets is such that diversifying is not so easy for countries in Central Asia. The Caspian oil from Tengiz and some other projects goes to a pipeline through Russia to Novorossiysk. If that were to somehow be affected by sanctions or tensions between Russia and the West, that could have a substantial adverse impact on Kazakhstan's economy. So by and large, I think the prudent person would see more downsides than potential upsides.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we are over time. We need to really wrap up the conversation here. So thank you very much.
I'm curious. I see that we went over an hour, but I also saw that Nargiz and Timur had something to say.
CBC, they're already, it's already affected. There was a Reuters piece.
I didn't see.
That there's already a report that buyers don't want to place orders until the end of March. So they're watching, seeing what's happening. So that seems that it will be affected. On the kind of...
So you are already seeing the impact of the sanction. How so? In which ways they are affected?
Well, if the buyers wouldn't want to use the CPC pipeline, you know, and that's the pipeline where, you know, kind of used by Kazakhstan to export most of its oil. So it could be very, very serious. But on the kind of what happens if Russia is successful, I put in quotation marks, in Ukraine, I think that it's pretty much destroyed most of its toolbox in a way of, you know, exerting influence. And, you know, because I don't know how we're going to live in the Eurasian Economic Union, given that the Russian economy is, you know, collapsing. Experts give it 2-3 weeks, you know, to kind of to feel the major effect. It's so dependent on imported parts and foreign investments and all that. So we're really in uncharted territories. As for opportunities, I hope that the opportunity that we have there with all these kind of major downfall that we're experiencing is that maybe the region will, you know, kind of try to do more things together. The situation now is even worse than in the 90s when we tried to kind of create the Central Asian Union. So we need to sort out our issues and, you know, kind of try not to go down in a big way.
Yeah. You know, when I say opportunities, I mean, what I had in mind was like, regardless of what Russia will think, Central Asia, for its own survival in the face of these sanctions against Russia, they need to find ways to do business with outside.
Absolutely.
Now that they are faced with this scenario in which they have to find ways to do business with outside beyond Russia, given the fact that in the face of current sanctions, there is little you can do with Russia. So what I'm saying is, could the situation provide a path for the region to craft a future for themselves in which Russia is perhaps one of many partners? So that's what I had in mind.
Yeah. But they've tried to diversify. There was the kind of everybody tried to diversify, right? Now the big challenge is to preserve this diversification that we have created prior to the crisis. But the only kind of, I think, clear outcome of this is that the weight of China in this new arrangement will be even higher.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's interesting to watch. And people keep saying, are they going to learn some lessons from this? And recent history would suggest that there's not much they can do, right? Because, there was the 2014 crisis in Ukraine. And then in 2015, when Turkey shot down that Russian plane, Russia wasn't going to trade with Turkey. And that was a disaster for the Central Asian. So, you know, just in the space of 2 years, less than 2 years, there was two major events that affected Central Asia and its ability to trade. And yet here we are, you know. So you kind of wonder if they're just not boxed in at this point. You know, expanding trade in the Chinese direction doesn't seem to be an option. They're already in too deep with China.
Yeah.
I think they're probably all watching China to see, you know, China's policy and Central Asia's policy toward what's happening in Ukraine are pretty much identical.
Right?
You know, they're trying not to get involved in it at all.
Yeah.
But China, as Ambassador Courtney suggested, is by abstaining at the UN, they showed that they're not really on board with this. But the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank also stopped its activities in Russia and Belarus, announced it yesterday. You know, and that's the Chinese-controlled bank for Belt and Road. So, you know, China's hinting that it's really uncomfortable with this. And if it starts to affect China's economy, I think they'll really be pressuring Russia a lot more to wrap this up one way or another and get it behind everybody as fast as possible. And the Central Asians are probably watching Beijing's moves and figuring once a heavyweight like China gets in, then maybe they can start articulating their genuine policies a little more publicly.
Yeah. And also, obviously, I mean, all these sanctions that are coming on Russia's way, how it's going to affect the China's Belt and Road project. Of course, there are lots of questions. I know, Timur, you had to say something. Can you really summarize your thoughts in just two paragraphs? With that, we will end the conversation.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that any opportunity is opening up right now for Central Asia. It's going to be a shock therapy. And I don't think that right now there is time to learn the lessons from this crisis. Mm. It is a test for all Central Asian countries to, you know, show the level of stability that they created for this last 30 years, the level of diversification of connection with the other countries except for Russia and all that. So right now, there is a huge moment of test for all Central Asian countries.
Okay. Thank you. I guess this has been one of the longest Majlis podcasts. I believe it was a worthwhile conversation. So thank you very much, Timur Umarov, a research fellow at the Carnegie Endowment in Russia. Also, big thanks goes to Ambassador William Courtney, former U.S. Ambassador to Kazakhstan, currently Adjunct Senior Fellow at the RAND Corporation. Dr. Nergis Kasanova, a Senior Fellow at the Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Euro-Asian Studies. And Bruce Panier, Senior Central Asia Analyst. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Liberty's Current Affairs Talk Show, focusing on Central Asia. Until next week, bye-bye.